Thank you. So I'm going to talk about a theorem which all of you have already heard about, except that I want to present you, which I hope is the final version of thereof. So the theorem is as follows. You have take a globally hyperbolic electrovacuum static regular black hole. Then this is either a Reisner-Nordström black hole or a Majumdar-Papapetru one. Of course, in the exterior region, because all these uniqueness theorems don't tell you anything about what's happening beyond the horizon, they only cover the exterior region. And what I have to tell you what regular here means. So regular is something, a condition which is essentially the one which one uses in positive energy theorem type of things. You want to capture the notion that a black hole is regular. Of course, the black hole will have singularities beyond the horizon, but you want the exterior region to be well behaved. And my way of capturing this is there is a space-like surface, which is some compact set, and perhaps a finite number of asymptotically flat ends. And this surface will have a boundary, perhaps, and when it has a boundary, this boundary has to lie on the event horizons. So this is a theorem. Before I go on, let me remind you what the standard Majumdar-Papapetru metrics are. So that's the form of the metric. This is not the form of the metric because this one has the wrong signature. But so whatever your favorite signature, just correct the sign there. And now this function phi is a finite number of monopoles. So if n is equal 1, this is actually nothing else but Reisner-Nordström in a special coordinate system. And but not any Reisner-Nordström, it's the degenerate one. So the extreme one where the charge is equal to the mass. So for every finite n, this is a spacetime which has n black holes. And each with every black hole, there is an event horizon associated. And each of these horizons is degenerate. So to fix the terminology, a Killing horizon is a null hypersurface on which a Killing vector is null. And of course, I'm assuming that the Killing vector is not null everywhere, but it's only null on this surface. And then... Right, because if you have, yeah, this is a good point. If you have a null hypersurface, there is only one direction which is tangent to it, which is null. So if the Killing vector is null, it has to be tangent to the generators of this, to the null geodesic on this horizon. And then when you have one of these Killing horizons, you introduce something called the surface gravity. And this is essentially telling you how the norm of the Killing vector varies when you cross the Killing horizon. This is telling you, well, on the Killing horizon, GXX is null. So the only thing that this derivative could be non-null is that it's in the transverse direction. Now, when this constant is zero, then this is, you say that the surface, well, this thing actually has the property of being constant in vacuum or electrovacuum. And when this constant is zero, then this means that this function has a zero of second order, while typically, it will be non-zero, then Killing vector changes sign from time-like to space-like. So on a degenerate horizon, it will, well, you don't quite know what it's going to do, but it's, you certainly don't know if it's going to change type, right? So, because if it's zero, then you only have, it could be a subtle point, it could be a minimum. Right, so this is again a good point. So if I'm in asymptotically flat spacetimes, there's a natural normalization of the Killing vector that it goes to a time translation in the asymptotic region, and then this fixes this normalization. Right. Okay, so these degenerate or extreme horizons are characterized by the property that this is zero. And an example is Reisner-Nordström with n equal q. Now, Well, what are the previous versions of the CRM? Well, there is one which is, I would say, a standard, which goes back to Israel and then with several names attached to it with various improvements. But the bottom line is, well, if you assume what everything I told you, and moreover that all horizons are non-degenerate, then the CRM is true. There is actually a version by Heusler which goes the other way. Assume everybody is degenerate, then the horizon is true. So the aim of this talk is actually to get rid of this hypothesis that everybody is either non-degenerate or degenerate, and show that that the result is true without assuming this. So the key, one of the key parts of the proof is a statement that near horizon geometry has no hair. This is really inspired by some work by Harvey Rial, which you can find in this reference. And the idea is following. We have this Killing horizon now in spacetimes, and we know everything and we already know that the CRM holds in everybody is non-degenerate. So the really interesting case now, what can we say about spacetime which have a degenerate Killing horizon? So what you do, the first thing is to understand the geometry near the horizon. And the way to do it is you introduce something which is called null Gauss coordinates. Sometimes that's something I've learned from a paper by Jim Eisenberg and Vince Moncrief in 1983, but presumably it's been used before. When you have a null hypersurface, you can introduce the equivalent of Gauss coordinates near the surface in which the metric will take such a form. So my horizon will be given by the coordinate r equals 0. So r is a coordinate of the horizon. Here I have a Killing vector, so it's going to be tangent to the generators on the horizon. It's du. And then, of course, it, that's du anyway. And xa are some kind of local coordinates on a cross section of this horizon. So this is r equals 0, and the Killing vector is tangent to the generators at r equals 0, and xa will be coordinates transversely. And the fact that, so this is quite a general form, while what is not completely general here is that, see, the Killing vector is null at the horizon, therefore g of du, which is nothing by guu, vanishes on the horizon. Now, a priori, there is no reason that this vanishes quadratically. But, however, as I've told you, we're interested in the case where this length vanishes to second order, and therefore you're picking up an r-square term here, right? So the analysis which follows needs this r-square here, and it would, I don't know how it, just what you can get in general, but not that I care at this stage. So you introduce this coordinate system, and the statement is the following. Well, we have a degenerate horizon. We're assuming staticity. We're assuming electrovacuum. And we're also assuming that this is not any silly null surface, but it has spherical cross sections. Okay. So if you assume that this holds, then, well, there's a few properties which I'm listening to you, and you will see later that all three are important in the later arguments, so it's not clear why they should be interesting, but anyway, here they are. This thing, well, you can always write it as something, the value at r equals 0 plus lower order terms. It turns out that this thing has to be a constant, and not only a constant, but a strictly positive constant. Okay, so it starts with a positive constant time lower order terms. So HAB would be a metric. Say it again. Which term? What's? Oh, okay. There's a DU missing. Yes, thanks. Yeah, there's a DU missing. Right. There's a DU missing. Okay. Now, so this guy has constant to leading order. If you multiply this metric here by this constant here, actually, to leading order, you find a round metric on a two-sphere, right? So that's what happens. And then another result, which will be needed later, is that the derivative of the electric potential is also related to this constant here, as follows, right? So this is really telling you that this the values of these fields at the horizon are uniquely determined by the setup, right? There's no a priori, this metric could be anything on a two-sphere, and then the Einstein-Maxwell equations and the hypothesis of degeneracy forces this thing to have no Hör, to be just the unidrawn metric. So the idea of the proof is rather simple. Well, you just, yeah, so I've written, repeated you this metric for your convenience, except that I'm keeping only here the values at r equals 0. So to leading order, you only those fields at r equals 0 matter. If you take the statisticity condition, you will find that this guy has actually to be a gradient. That's not very surprising. Now, the interesting equation is this one. You write down the Einstein-Maxwell equations, and one of the equations, so AB are the indices here in this two-dimensional object, which is sphere in our case, you're going to get this cute equation that the Ricci tensor of this metric is proportional to such a combination of gradients of lambda. Now, those of you who are familiar with the static Einstein equations, if you just take the 3 plus 1 dimensional static Einstein equations and decompose 3 plus 1, decompose it, then you're going to get something very similar for this equation. You get that if you make some rescaling, you're going to get exactly this equation up to but without the 1 half here. You get a different factor here. So this is resembles a lot just the 3 plus 1 decomposition of Einstein equations, except that this is 2 plus 2. And you're going to get this equation. So now you do some work. You assume that this has S2 topology. You look at this equation. You do various things to it. I'm not going to describe this to you. It just takes a few pages. It's not very difficult. But you'll find that lambda has to be a constant. Then, of course, you can just say it's zero. And this guy has actually to vanish. And, well, if lambda is a constant, then this drops out. And you get that this metric is the proportional, yes, the Ricci is proportional to the metric. Of course, if you're on an S2, this proportionality constant has to be positive, and then you look at the other equations and you'll find that the value of A naught is proportional to this guy, which tells you that it's non-zero and positive, and also you can work out the other. Right, I mean, you could have C equals zero. There's no Gauss-Bonnet, there are no flat metrics on S2. You could have C negative again on S2. There are no. Yeah, so this is Gauss-Bonnet for the sign of this.
It's there?
Is
that for that?
Yes, right, yeah. And only just to determine this. The other thing is just, yeah. Well, takes some time, but I don't have time to explain this. So, let me mention, well, first that this equation is actually, you could, if you like, to look at Einstein equations higher dimensions, you can repeat something very similar. Rather than having two-dimensional indices here, you're going to have more indices. You're going to end up with this equation or some similar version thereof. And I think it would be interesting to analyze what's happening in this equation in general, not only in this simplest case that we looked at with Paul. And this point has already been emphasized by Harvey Real when he had a lecture here. Some partial results about this are to be found in Lewandowski-Pawłowski, but it would be interesting to have a complete description of this kind of geometries. So that's where my slides stop. So now, yeah, so yeah, the nights are too short here. So now, how do we continue? Because this was this first theorem, which tells you what's happening near the horizon. So how do you make your global argument now? So most of what I'm going to tell you is essentially the standard proof, which is due to, as I've already mentioned, Masoudou Lalam, Walter Simon, and Rubach. And then at some stage I will show you how to do the missing step. So now this is the proof of Noether. And so the first step is something, a result which is due to Boyer, Carter, and Vishveshvara. So there is an argument which uses information about, uses staticity and global information about space-time and things like that, which tells you that if you define the function v square or, well, if you look at gxx, then this is strictly larger than zero except, so on sigma, let me remind you what I told you, remind you what sigma is. Well, let me, so remember my setup was the following. I have the space-time which has this asymptotically flat surface sigma here, which has perhaps several black holes sitting there, maybe some topology, and this Boyer-Carter-Vishveshvara lemma or theorem or series of result is telling you that in this space-time, the Killing vector has to be strictly time-like except on the boundary, okay, at this sigma. So let me call this function v square. Probably. Well, let me continue here. So this was step one. So let's see. Step two would be topological censorship, essentially due to Friedrich Schlein-Witt, which tells you that sigma is simply connected, and d sigma is a bunch of spheres. So this justifies my hypothesis before that these cross-sections have to be spheres. This justifies what I said, and also simply connected does imply that the electric field is actually the gradient of some potential. Topological censorship tells you also that sigma has only one asymptotically flat end, while a priori I could have had several. So therefore, I can normalize phi so that it goes to zero as r goes to infinity. And so this fixes quite a bit the topology. Next, there's a nice result by Hoesler, which tells you that you can assume that the magnetic field vanishes. So after a global duality rotation, you have that B is equal to zero. A priori, you can have both an electric and magnetic field in a static space-time, but then you can rotate one into another, and there is a choice of constants which leads to this. So So what we're going to do now is to look at the orbit space metric. Which is defined as, if the Killing vector is, say, the zero, whatever the zero coordinate is, then this orbit space metric is defined as DAG. I have to be careful about the signature, so this signature is just this thing. And now there is a nice equation which is satisfied by the fields under consideration. If I look at the Laplacian with respect to this orbit space metric of the function v plus phi minus 1, so let me remind you that v is the square root of the Lorentzian length of the Killing vector, and phi is the electric potential. For this, think satisfies a nice equation. This is an observation of Masudul Alam and independently Simon and independently Rubach. One has a maximum principle for this function. This is zero. And there is the same equation if you put a plus here. So you can actually, here. So rather if you put a minus here. You actually have, this is rather not unexpected because of course everything is invariant on changing the electric field to minus the electric field. So you have one equation like that, you have the other one as well. So you see this equation has no zero order term. So there's a Laplacian in a metric which is Riemannian. Well, the metric has problems when G00 vanishes. But it is Riemannian elsewhere. And therefore, if you stay away from the boundary, this is a nice elliptic operator. There are only first derivative terms, so you have a maximum principle for this. So you can apply, you know what is the asymptotics of the fields far away. You know what happens more or less at the horizon. So you apply the maximum principle to this metric, and you're going to get something cute, that the absolute value of phi is controlled by this inequality, with phi equal 1, possible only at degenerate horizons. So, if you have no degenerate horizons, you know that the inequality is strict, and then you do something which is, again, fairly standard for those who know this kind of things. You make a doubling of a manifold and use the max positive energy theorem to finish the proof. Now, so here, I am going to worry about exactly this possibility. Phi equal 1, you're going to see in a minute how this enters in the argument and why this might be a problem and why this ends up not being a problem. So this doubling construction actually uses two conformal factors. Omega plus minus is equal 1/4 1 plus minus v square minus phi square. Maybe I should just do it like that because one sees much better what's happening. And now what you're going to do is this. You're going to look at the matrix G plus minus is equal omega plus minus square gamma, if you can. Okay? Now, the key observation here is that, well, if you can do that, then the scalar curvature of both those guys is positive. And that's what allows you to use eventually the positive energy theorem at the end. So why would you not be able to do that? Well, there's an obvious possibility that one of these functions is zero. Okay? So for example, if phi is equal 1 minus v, so you can't do it. Phi is equal 1 minus v, then omega minus is zero. Now, if you look at the Majumdar Papapetru metric, which I was here on one of my slides, which would be take me perhaps 3 minutes to get back to, so I'm probably not going to do it, but this is what happens in Majumdar Papapetru, right? So in this case, if you look at Majumdar Papapetru, you just directly see that this holds, and the other direction here is actually something I have proved years ago, but with Nadirashvili. So, this bad case leads to Majumdar Papapetru, if and only if Majumdar Papapetru get this, and therefore, for now on, let us assume that we are not Majumdar Papapetru. Okay? So, assume not. So I have 2 minutes to conclude. So, three. So let me just make some choices in what I'm going to tell you. I can tell you how you finish the proof without going into the details, but now what we're going to exploit is this information we had on this metric near the horizon. So, near the horizon, so since I have 3 minutes, I will not do this calculation. This calculation would take me 3 minutes, but then I will not have time to do anything more. But so, you just take this space-time metric I wrote, and use on sigma coordinates r and xa, and what you're going to find that gab is equal 1 over a naught r square dr square plus r square h naught ab plus lower order terms. Okay, so H naught AB is exactly this metric, which was the leading order behavior of the metric, this transverse metric on the horizon, and we've seen that this guy is, and you could probably need this A naught here, actually. So, that this part is just the round metric on the sphere. And the horizon is r equals 0. But if you look at this equation, well, you just think, well, this is not nothing but the Euclidean metric written in spherical coordinates, because I have dr square here. I have a round metric on the sphere multiplied by r square. So what was the horizon in this no-Gauss coordinate system of Heisenberg and Moncrief after this rescaling, which is, of course, singular, is becoming in Cartesian coordinate, just an origin of a coordinate system in this in a Cartesian coordinate system plus terms order x. Good. So this is gamma AB. Now, if I look at omega square plus minus, well, omega square is here. So at the horizon, well, v vanishes, because this is where the killing vector goes null. So v vanishes. So this is like 1. Now phi is equal 1 or minus 1. So this thing vanishes. Here you'll get the same, of course, because v again is 0. So you have 1 square minus phi square. Phi is plus minus 1. So both these factors vanish. Now, if you put in these numbers I've told you, how these things relate to each other, you're going to find that omega plus behaves like a constant times R square, which is going precisely to cancel this, so that G plus is a regular metric. And if you look at the other conformal factor, it has a zero of higher order, so G minus will be a function, which let me write it to phi to the 4, times, again, a regular metric. Well, relatively regular, because this metric is actually something which is continuous, and then order terms which are order of x. So this has bounded derivatives, but second derivatives blow up. Okay, so there is a small technicalities here, which have to be taken into account when you finish the argument. But in any case, you get G plus is regular, while G minus is phi to the 4 some regular metric, and this guy has a zero at the origin. And you get a contradiction now by writing the transformation law for the conformal factor. You know that R of G minus is positive, but this is equal, well, if I multiply it by phi to 5, I think, that this is equal minus Laplacian phi plus R of G plus phi. Well, if you didn't have this term, so suppose you don't have this term, then this equation is telling you that Laplacian G plus phi is negative. But then this function, the function which has a negative Laplacian, cannot have an interior minimum, so phi of 0 is not possible. Okay, good. And so that's the end of the proof. There's a few pages of technicalities which you need to do to make sure that this term doesn't change the argument, and also because everybody is slightly singular at the origin, so you just can't apply Gilbert and Schrödinger, but you do a little work, and so there are no her. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
You just use G plus and complete it with the point R equals not, and use the conformal factor of positive mass theorem.
No, I'm not using the positive mass theorem here. I'm just using...
Could you just forget about the G minus K, complete the point with the G plus, and do the doubling with the rest of the horizon?
No, because, well, the reason I can do it is that you really have to use both metrics to do the... to use the positive energy theorem, because when you double, you take G plus on one side, G minus on one side. So G plus will be well behaved, but G minus is not. So you have singularities in G minus which you can't control, and you can't. Right. We've been trying something like that, and well, anyway, this is actually simpler because this is purely local now. You don't need any global argument. Of course, you need global arguments to do just to then finish the proof after having excluded this case. But I mean, this has been done by previous people. So. Well, so what would be this what would be the hypothesis then? The geometry is static, but the or this kind of follows from these.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't. Yeah. Well, so I didn't say it follows. I said kind of follows. Okay. From this, yeah. So this Wheaton theory, right? That if the geometry is static, then the fields are almost static. I have no idea. Okay, that's the answer.
Your argument would have trouble getting that round sphere.
Well, we've assumed, right?
Well, you couldn't do, I don't think you couldn't in general do the Hoyle-Pickering
Well, I wouldn't even know about what Greg said to analyze this near horizon geometry. If I see, here I'm dividing this metric by A naught. A naught was of the function of the metric, which might have zeros, or might vanish altogether, right? Then this becomes a disaster. That's well, right, yeah, but I mean, to get the information that this thing here is a constant, a positive constant, and also that this thing is a round metric on the sphere, I'm using the full Einstein equations, Einstein-Maxwell equations, and if it's dynamical, I don't know. That's certainly part of the argument.
But if you're just using the Einstein part of the Einstein,
no, we're using everything.
We're using the Maxwell part.
Right, yeah, we're using everything. Well, I had to say that there's no Rubik proof. There are Rubik ideas, which are right eventually. But yeah, there's a kind of proof. Rubik takes a different conformal factor, which runs you into serious problems if you want to do what I said. If you don't have definite horizons, you can make Rubik's ideas into a proof. But there's no way I could see how to do these degenerate horizons in his, right? He takes a slightly different conformal factor. He's using the same maximum principle on this equation to control his factors, but because they behave differently at zeros, this case I have no idea how to do it. On the other hand, if you assume that there are no degenerate horizons, then Rubik gives you an argument which can be eventually made rigorous.
This idea of using the orbit space method rather than the one on equal constants, that has appeared before. Have you used that before?
Well, I have used this in my previous papers. The idea here is this helps you to minimize the number of conditions you have on space-time. Because if you use the induced metric, usually there are all these things that this surface has to finish on the bifurcation surface, but is there a bifurcation surface? So you have to put a lot of things more into the statement to make it work. But if you just use this trick, then a lot of hypotheses can be removed. This is a cheap trick to get rid of various. This gamma ij? No, I mean, this gamma ij is really something very trivial. If you're in a static situation, this is the metric you would get as the metric induced on the static surface. Okay? I give you the metric in any coordinate system, then this is, you work out what you will get on a static surface, that's what you'll get. Except that if you want to assume to start with that you have a static surface with good properties, this imposes a lot of restrictions on the geometry. Why, if you just look at this here? Well, it's static here, so yeah, you control everything by it.
Thank you.
Thank you.